The best mixes aren't with automation. They're not with compression. But this idea with crushing everything helped Manny Morroka to mix because everything was at the same kind of crunch. And so all he had to do was match them up, and he had a mix. He didn't have to do, you know, that thing, what did we used to call it? Mixing.
Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest in this episode is Grammy-winning producer, engineer, educator, and audio legend, George Massenburg. Among George's more than 400 engineering credits include Earth, Wind & Fire, Dolly Parton, Linda Ronstadt, James Taylor, The Grateful Dead, and Phil Collins. A gifted audio designer, George literally invented the parametric equalizer, and his GML products are widely known for their superior sonics. He continues that work in the digital domain today with plugins from his Massenburg Design Works. During our talk, George spoke about the importance of critical listening, his 50-year quest for the perfect dynamics controller, working on Earth, Wind, and Fire's biggest hits, and much more. I spoke with George via Zoom from his office near Nashville. It seems to me that a great portion of your life has been focused on dynamic control, and I'm talking about your development life, your development of gear, plugins. It's been about dynamic control. It's been something you've been chasing for a long time. So, and you have a different philosophy than most people on it. So help me out on this.
Well, when so I started the equalizer in 68, 69, and we had a studio that I would set up, this little box on the console that I had built, and tweaked it. And friend was going to Hopkins around those years, and we had a band, and they would come in, and I'd try these things. And by end of 69, 70, the two guys that owned the studio sold it to ITI, a video company. And we built a console for ITI. And said, well, wow, that's an interesting idea. Let's do that equalizer. So to make a long story short, in a couple of years, we had the Parametric up for sale. It was at the LA show in 72 in spring, where I met David Blackmer. And David Blackmer said, well, that's all interesting, but here's what I'm doing. And showed me the basic Blackmer VCA and a thing that he had worked on for API, which was a very clever way to do smoothing using all pass filters. And my friend, a very good friend, Dwayne Wise, I turned Dwayne Wise onto it, and he does it that way too. It's too complicated to go into right now, but we each sort of set our sails to do dynamics. Dwayne with his parametric EQ, and you'll note that I don't compete with Dwayne Wise. He is my filter guy. Back to the beginning of the MDW equalizer. I'm jumping around. I met David Blackmer, turned me on to RNS control in this style that was already in DBX 160s and soon to be 165s and had some very interesting features. So I set sail for a different kind of dynamics range control because I had an 1176 and it was god awful. It still is god awful. I'll use it on some things now and then. And I'm a friend of Bill Senior's, so I don't want to say anything too bad. Started dynamics control and built modules and what to do. Okay, so I moved to Paris with X1 and had a lab there on the Champs-Élysées and was trying to freelance for Francophone clientele for the most part. Hated me, so... You know, it was an interesting experience. But I'd been recording for a good long time by then. My hits were all in bluegrass, in direct two-track bluegrass for Rebel Records, which is where I met John Starling, which is where I met Emmylou Harris, which is where I met Linda Ronstadt, is working for the Seldom Scene, a band out of Washington, D.C. So there's always kind of been these three things were so going on with me where I'm always designing something. There's a breadboard on top of the console. We're going through old multi-track tapes in the basement, and I'm drawing schematics on the back of tape boxes. And generally, I'd have a prototype of the latest version of the compressor sitting on the console. I'd be tweaking it and occasionally arriving at something where a Lowell George or an artist would say, I can really hear myself. It was all a matter of finding that sweet spot in the vocal chain so that everybody was happy. You were happy going to storage, post-haste tape. You were happy getting the voice under some kind of control to save the drummer's ears. You were happy to help the drummer's pitch because I could, in the phones, level the vocal and find his or her pitch against the tuning instrument and just ride that pitch and really help the vocalists sing. So that was the beginnings of development. Later, I did another one for the Big Earth, Wind & Fire touring system, which I built in 79, 80, 81. And we did the Earth, Wind, established Earth, Wind & Fire shows as this giant show with low end and real low end, but a really good system. And I did more work with dynamics there so that you could get some leveling off of the stage and make these concerts sound like the record. That was my claim to fame. My hand is casting shadow on my face, so I've got to be careful of that. And so I got distracted. My claim to fame was a live show that sounded pretty close to the record. And part of that was dynamics control. And then time passes, and I did dynamics for the Oxford console. And it's funny, but we just took apart the Oxford console. And part of it, I had to do it because it had been just sitting in the basement for 20 years, and my wife wanted to reclaim the space. And she deserved to have that space. So she's got that space now. So what I did for Oxford was to just soak up as much as I could from this brilliant digital design team, headed by Peter Eastie and some insiders, Rod Denching, John East, who had done a lot of front ends for SSL, just coming right across town, and Paul Frindle. And Paul and I sat for, and back that's back then when I smoked and he has never stopped, and did the GML EQ and the GML Dynamics on the Oxford console. And it was well thought of, but there were only, was Marco Migliari, the chief engineer, he and I hooked up, and they had Oxford consoles right to the end. They finally got rid of him. He's now the Oxford guy in Europe. And then I find out that there are consoles around. So that's a rough. And then we did, I did one at Blackbird around 2004, 2007. Then we started actually going heavily into Jim Pace and I putting up plugins, became MDW, our partnership. And we put out the EQ. It did very well in 2002, 3, 4, 5. We were one of the main, the EQ plugin was one of the main plugins on the original Digi system that closed the sale. Hey, here's a plugin that sounds like analog. Closed sales. And we did very well. We were a little longer getting the DRC out, but we finally got the DRC out.
So your approach is different in that you don't build compressors. You build dynamic controllers.
Yeah.
And that's a different philosophy. It's a different way.
Well, and the philosophy is just based on how we mix, because the best mixes aren't with automation. They're not with compression. Sometimes they're helped by dynamic range control, but I'll get to the more benign applications later. But this idea with crushing everything helped Manny Morokin to mix because everything was at the same kind of crunch. And so all he had to do was match them up, and he had a mix. He didn't have to do, that thing, what did we used to call it? Mixing.
Yeah, right.
But my favorite mixers, Phil Ramone, Bill Schnee, Al Schmidt, of course, not my favorite guy, but one of my favorite mixers is Glenn Johns. And my favorite mixers were very used to taking chances with the mix, especially Bill, who just reaches all the favorites right for it. And that's ear. And that has more to do with the loudness of a sound than its electrical level. And the problem with using compressors, I don't even want to start using regular old level detecting compressors. You know, everything from the detector to the controller is just all wrong, and it's been a lonely journey. But the inspiration is, well, wow, if I can make something that does a minimum, then I could finish it by hand. And so that's what I was hoping for, was something that could do clip gain, an equivalent of going through and doing clip gain, because it's pretty fast responding, and then it slows down when it gets in a sweet zone and then does true RMS. The patent, by the way, just to get geeky for a second, the patent is, you know, true RMS, as you know, is true RMS. It's arithmetic. Arithmetic, sum of squares, that's arithmetic. Hearing is logarithmic. The ears, perception of loudness has everything to do with a logarithmic scale. So my patent is based on Dave Blackmore's ingenious application of his deep knowledge of a transistor, a PN junction. Dave Blackmore was a master of understanding the PN junction. And he applied it to not only the VCA, but he applied it to RMS conversion. It's the cheapest RMS converter ever. And, of course, there are others that are good. What's his name? That corporation has a very good one, Wide Range. But I did one with a matched pair and all kinds of temperature corrections. So that's 1/10 of a dB or better across 80 dB and very fast response. So the 8900 that I take a lot of shit for, hey, how about that crest control? Where's the gleam control? Ha, 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 ha. You know, that
yeah, right.
was a very accurate unit. And since we stopped making it, its price has skyrocketed because we couldn't make it anymore. We couldn't. It was economically not feasible now that we had the digital version of it to redo the analog version, except that our product planning board still has the digital control, which is exactly the same as the analog control, just on the digital domain, exactly that they cancel. I can cancel an 8900 with a DRC2 or cancel to 50 dB down, but that's
yeah.
To have a VCA backend, we built the VCA, have VCA backend and an ARM or something running the digital front end with a very fast converter, which will do very low latency. So I actually have an analog version of the DRC, or you could call it a digital version of the 8900.
Yeah, you know, well.
So that's boring enough.
Yeah, I get it. You're passionate about critical listening. And when you were teaching, and you taught for a lot of years, that was central to the education that you were imparting.
It still is.
What does that mean to you, critical listening?
Critical evaluation is, to me, taking off all layers of judgment of music and listening to loudness in context. I didn't mention Elliot, but Elliot is one of those guys that doesn't care what I think. Doesn't care what you think. He's been making the same beautiful record for a very long time. He's just done a new Madeline Perot and put it up on Immersive Audio Album, which is about the only place left we can go. I guess Chesky. But now that the title's failed, and I mentioned that the other day, so I'll go into Tidal.
Yeah.
But the it started with Tidal putting this up as a 9624 and Kyle Lennon calling me and saying, you know, I listened to Madeline and I got the CD and, you know, Tidal sounds a little dark. Yeah. So I went on Tidal and it says 9624, you know, no more MQA. I loved MQA. Or did I take hours in the back on MQA? A quick quote that got me a lot of arrows in the back. Ready?
Go for it.
Lossless in the analog domain. They fell on my bones and shredded every ounce of meat off my body. Losses in the analog domain. They didn't have MQA up. They had taken MQA down and replaced it with 9624. So I'm listening, and it's dark. I look over on the spectrum analyzer on the EQ, and it's rolling off at 22K. That's not...
Yeah, right.
624. So I ripped it and did a full analysis, and brick wall, 22K. They had actually ripped, they had re-rendered it at 44. Oh. Bastards. So yeah. I'm bailing on Tidal. Morton Lindbergh, they went to Morton Lindbergh and said, can you, this is all coming back to critical listening. Morton Lindbergh was called to deliver his 192.24s to Tidal to replace the MQAs. And in short order, he hung up on them, called his attorney, and gave him a takedown notice. Because there is no way he can have them do that to an MQA master, one of his masters, ruin it. And it didn't ruin Elliot's thing, but it was noticeable. And that's where critical listening begins, is instead of listening to, well, I ought to be able to hear more tinkle on the hi-hat at 96K. No.
If you're tired of your mixes coming out muddy, thin, or lifeless, I have great news. You can take the quality of your mixes from amateur to pro level using the techniques of the world's top mixers. I'll show you these quick solutions to 15 common mix problems with my Mix Fix playbook. Go to go.bobbyosinski.com/mixfix to check it out now.
I ought to be able to hear, take your pick, something, chime, bell, something with attack. It should make a snare, but no. What we find is that the time resolution is better. And time resolution, to me, for the longest time, has meant to be able to do two things. One, to be able to identify and evaluate very small sounds in the presence of larger sounds. What would normally be called masking, or what did Carl Helms call it? Perceptual coding. Jimmy Johnson, two very dear friends, Carl Heinz and Jim Johnston, the creators of more shitty codecs than anybody except for that group.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
But what that is, it's depending on frontal left brain and your evaluation, usually in an eight fast switch A-B test, frontal left brain. And, you know, you can tell very rough things. You can differentiate a zither and orchestral bells. But for very fine resolution.
Oh, there we go. I remember that.
We're taking the faders out because they're the best faders ever in the history of faders. They're a Panasonic fader. It's a linear motor. Justin? Bobby Osinski. Bobby? Justin.
Nice to meet you.
You had to lean in.
Hey, Justin.
There you go.
Hello. It's nice to meet you.
You were the guy with harness around us.
Yes.
So back to the story. So this thing with small sounds in the presence of big sounds is something that is the, you'll remember from loving music, is the evolution of your story of a record, where, I don't know, the Beatles came out on a CD and you heard things you never heard before, or why didn't I hear that before, or whatever that story is, or maybe been lucky enough to hear L2 record at a show, one of Morton Lindbergh's beautiful 7 and 9 speaker creations. And the detail is existence defining. And a lot of that is right brain. That's deep right brain. That's the right brain finding a story in the sound and not just the beat or the groove or whatever that thing is, that surface thing is, but something that we experience that we know immediately is the record that we loved from 20 years ago and 30 years ago. Now, that immediately marks me for a takedown. Yeah, you old guys, you don't know shit about new music. Well, I like new music too. This thing of Elliott's, you would do yourself a favor by listening to the Madeline Perrault because it's just beautiful. But it's the opposite of a Dr. Dre mix. It's the opposite of Pink. It's the opposite of that supercharged, bright yellow, every color, Peter Max contrast maximum. The way I dealt with it is the student would put up a mix and I'd have to evaluate it, but I'd start from the smallest things. You know, they've done all the wrong EQ on the piano. Say, listen to this piano. What do you hear? Let's take your EQ off and I'll tell you what I hear. And the most dramatic episodes were ones where a student says, well, it's really bright. I've got to take the mid-range down. Or worse, it's really muddy. Let's roll all the low end off. Where you find, by listening, closing your eyes and listening, any frequency in the low end that's resonating, invariably you'll find resonance is in an acoustic guitar that are inharmonic, and maybe one is dominant, and you can change everything by a very sharp tip at that resonant frequency. Well, now that's common practice. But when I was doing it, and arguably I was the first to do it because I had the first parametric and had to learn what its use case was. If you got those muddy things like a 105 hertz ring on a snare drum, just not take it up, just bring it down. Or that rock and roll edge in a snare drum, that sort of rank edge, locate it and turn it up. And you got more rock and roll in the snare drum. So would approach criticalism from the standpoint of honing a student's chops so that they could work through a mix quickly. In a real orchestral situation, it takes a real orchestral setting. How you judge your decatree, where you put your decatree, how high, how far, how deep, where the outriggers are. And what benefited me at McGill was not the love of my colleagues because I was thrust in a situation where everybody hated me. There's nothing worse than joining a university and expecting love and support. You're competing with everybody for money, and they only want to see you dead, out, gone. And eventually they got rid of me. But what I learned was from my colleagues, Martha DeFrancisco and Richard King, variations on how to really hone in on symphonic presentation. So now I'm mixing, I told you I'm mixing this Hedgehog record, Sonic the Hedgehog, which is all orchestral. It's all the sonic themes for the whole history of Sonic the Hedgehog. And it's glorious. Anyway, back to critical listening. Critical listening is, but then I'm starting out with, where I start with drums is, let's get the overheads, right? Let's do an Al Schmidt. Let's get the overheads in exactly the right place so that the snare drum is centered already. And that's the other thing that I've taken a lot of shit for, is I offset the height of the left and right drum overheads because what I want is a solid kick and snare in the overheads, and then dial in the snare mic to just the right spot in that perspective. Now, that's a certain kind of drum. It's not for everybody. It's not for jazz where you got more cymbal work and salad, but it's one of four, five, six ways to do it.
But see, you're talking about realism here, and everything here is how realistic is it to the we're used to every day. Yeah. And that's not always what a mix is going for.
And that's exactly why when we mixed Alicia, I had to relearn everything that I did to do the remixes on Alicia. I relearned everything because the first thing that we did on Alicia was we had to do a sound alike. That's the other thing I skipped over because I didn't want to bear down. But we'll circle back to talk about sound alikes. But I did a sound alike where I took Manny Barocan's and Serban's mixes and did sound-alikes, which meant that I had to buy waves. Nothing has galled me more than having to buy a Chris Lord-Alge bass module that didn't do shit. Or nothing. But I bought it, Bark, whatever it is, Platinum, so that I could do a sound-alike and hear and actually have the record. Because I had to, after we did, I had one mix that I could do from scratch, which was a new record along with Randy. But after that, we had to copy the mixes. Friends and foes alike, I had to walk past all feelings that I had about what they were doing. And Manny Barocan's were the worst. Manny would saturate an SSL, a 6K, 6J bus, saturate a 6J bus, a 9J bus, and then crush it with an analog thing externally, then bring it back into the bus and crush the output of the bus and print it. That's Manny's style. It is really hard to reverse engineer that kick drum because everything about it is fucked up. So on things like Girl on Fire, I had to do what it took to mix Girl on Fire so it sounded like Alicia's record. And that's where I learned what I could get away with on Reverb, a whole new movie on Reverb, a lot less, how to broaden the sweet spot, and that's where I started using Spat Revolution and using that to broaden the sweet spot. What I've learned about pulling images out in the immersive space, wait for it, pitch shifting a little.
Oh, there you go. Wow.
And a little bit of delay, a little bit of pitch shift, a little bit of placement, so that the objects don't comb filter. Or if they do, it moves around and fools the ear. So we learned a lot about how to make a new record, but I don't like new records as much as I like classical music. I love early Baroque. I listen to early Baroque every night. I love Glenn Gould. I have one favorite keyboard player in the world, ahead of all the others. I love Larry Goldings. What a brilliant player. But boy, what Glenn Gould. I mean, he really did some damage. Yeah. He did damage to every subsequent pianist that calls himself a pianist. I'm sorry, get off subject. But the critical listening is being able to do that thing where you step outside of your feelings about the music. I mean, I can mix klezmer, I can mix country.
Let's go there for a second. So you've mixed all sorts of different genres, and you obviously feel comfortable, but what do you prefer?
I prefer finding something wrong and fixing it. So I prefer whatever that is, and my young and brilliant assistant, Justin, is the same way. He's great at troubleshooting. And in analog, I mean, man, if you knew what was going on inside most of these plugins, you would never use another plugin, except maybe mine. It's just awful. It's just bad work. So,
okay, why is that? Is that because people are doing a follow the leader thing?
Yep, and probably people that you've interviewed. One comes to mind. That guy, he copied my 8900 and got it wrong. The AMEC Master EQ, he copied. Now he won't answer my calls. Well, he's gone now. He just copied it. I mean, and proudly, and it didn't sell. I mean, it went from 395 to 195 to 95 to 25 in a hurry. It's a real piece of shit. He even got some of the controls backwards. But he had a young Ukrainian engineer actually hack it together. And the guy got in touch with me and apologized to me for being pushed by Dirk to create that thing. And one of these days, we're going to find this guy and hire him and bring him back to Tennessee.
Wow. That'd be a good story there. Definitely.
Life is about, and if he gets this message, I forgot his name, but I invite him to be in touch. Dirk, I don't care. Dirk is going to suffer. what Dirk Beast said. But, you know, we're all in it for, you know, the thing I miss on Mainly Getting Mixing, I don't know why, but I'm mainly getting mixing. But it's not as much fun as being in the studio. Being in the studio was a fucking blast. It was fun. A lot of laughs, somebody always telling a joke.
Well, it's a camaraderie that you get. And that's kind of fun because we don't, modern records aren't made like that anymore.
Sometimes they are. And when they are, like I've got this small group of guys that I got together with. It's Pat Bergeson and Pete and with Don Sherrill, who I did all this advertising for music. And we get together in his barn and we just have a party. And it's great. So it's about a couple times I've gotten people to pay for us.
You know,
but yeah, camaraderie.
When you look back, what's the best project you ever did?
Well, that's tough.
That can go different ways in that the most one you had the most fun or one that you just feel that came out quality-wise the best.
It was the most fun being on the road with Little Feet in the 70s. That was fun, but it wasn't a very grown-up thing to continue. The best project as far as outcome and gratification and learning something have been the records I did with Peter Asher because he's relentless. He's a perfectionist and in a field that's not perfectible, but that doesn't mean that we don't strive for perfection. And the records I made with Linda it was gratifying being in a room with a very intelligent couple of people that we had a rapport and filled in gaps in each other's knowledge and maybe missed and maybe not. And so the Linda records, and I did quite a few and still talk to her and want to help her. She doesn't sing anymore, so we're not going to do that, but she's still the smartest. She's the smartest, brightest crayon in the pack. And she's the muse of my life, as is my wife. So it's the musicians that I got to work with that define the great moments. The outcome, September is going through third and fourth generation now, discovering the song September. And I just did an interview for a very smart guy, Thompson, but Questlove. He's doing an Earth, Wind & Fire documentary. I trust him to do this documentary. He's doing it along with Maurice's son, and he's getting the guidance, and he assured me that he doesn't want to just paint a rosy Valentine of Earth, Wind & Fire.
Yeah, you have sort of a love-hate relationship with him, I feel.
Well, I spent too long with him. Same thing with McGill. I was there for 13 years. I should have gotten out when this grifter of a dean came in, and her job was to get rid of me. And she was and is one of the most awful people I have ever met. There's absolutely nothing about her that has any positive characteristic. And she got rid of them. It took me a couple years to catch on, though. But Earth, Wind, Fire was the same thing. Maurice hated me and just made it clear that he, at every possible juncture, that he was the boss. He was the boss. His name is on the back. He got way more than his share of the revenue. And that meant that he was the boss. And that meant that I had to sneak around and try to fix his fuck-ups to make these records fly. And when I left right after Let's Groove. Let's Groove tonight.
Yeah.
Right after that, and I don't think they ever really had another record. They didn't have another record. I mean, they made records and took Sony's money, but they never had another record.
Yeah, not one like that, that's for sure.
But, so it's not a love-hate relationship. It's a melancholy tinged with sadness. Tinged with great times in the studio with the cats. Two or three of them I'm still friends with. Larry Dunn is a superb keyboard player who was also marginalized by Maurice. And, you know, it is what it is. It was time to perform.
Yeah. All right. Last question then, George. What's the best piece of advice that maybe you learned along the way or somebody imparted to you?
Learn how to manage money.
I love that. That's great. And so true.
Learn how to manage money. It doesn't have to be a serious thing, but accumulating capital. I learned this from, what's his name, Warren Buffett. The only reason you want to own a company is so that you can direct where assets go, where capital is spent. It's the only reason to own a company. Otherwise, you know, work for somebody else. But if you want to make sure that the benefits of your work and your colleagues' work goes into something productive, and only you know what that is, that's a reason to own a company and be an independent producer. You know, I like Andrew Sheps a lot. He does what you do. Has a little different spin on it.
Yeah.
He does what you do, which is research, and he plays his cards very close. And I appreciate that. I like Andrew's mixing too.
Yeah. Yeah.
He has one dark spot in his record that we would keep reminding him he needs to stop saying.
Yeah, that's my good.
I won the loudness war.
Yeah, that's right.
Never say that again. Andrew, please.
Well, he does it with tongue in cheek, but nonetheless.
But I mean, we won the loudness war when loudness measurements came into play. But you know what? Speaking of efforts, the work that we did with Thomas Lund and Bob Katz and my buddy in Vienna, Florian Kammer.
Oh, right.
We started doing exposing this idea of crushing records after the 2004 Metallica debacle. I don't think we'll ever get any credit for it, but we hammered away at loudness to audiences. I don't know whether you, here's what I want to live, is when at the end of World War II, General Marshall, who was at some point ran the European theater, moved into the Marshall Plan in late Roosevelt, early Truman. It was the Marshall Plan to save Europe, where he did enough to not make the mistakes that we made in World War II, and saved Germany, saved Europe, saved the economy of Europe. And when asked why he didn't get more credit, he said famously that much can be accomplished when one is not worried, is not consumed by getting credit for all that one does. The Marshall Plan. And died a happy man. So, I mean, I think Thomas Lund and Florian Kammer and Bob Katz, and I will eventually be identified as the ones that started talking about it in Rome in 2002, 2003, and eventually turned into the Calm Act. So I feel better about doing that. I feel better about teaching. I feel better about my students coming back to me and saying, yeah, I know you yelled a lot and sometimes you made me cry, but my God, I learned a lot.
Yeah, what more can you want than that? That's great.
What more could you want? So thank you. I don't want to take too much advantage of your time.
That's a good place to stop, I think. In the meantime,
Show you something. Can you see the goosebumps?
Yeah.
These two.
One day, Justin and I are going to build a very expensive little console with these faders because they're the best fader ever made.
Yeah.
And we've got 100 and something.
Oh, yeah. Can't wait to see it.
Anyway.
George, yeah, thank you. Good to talk to you, as always. And we'll talk. Yep. Take care.
Thank you, Bobby. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news, and find out about openings for my latest online classes at bobbyosinski.com. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.